We have one of Ultra's Ultra Runners with us, Candace Burt. Candace, thank you for joining us. We're here talking about some of the greatest trail running shoes that are on the market right now at ultra.com. We know you're a sponsored athlete. Tell us a little bit about a strategy that you use when you're out there running the trails.
Well, one strategy that I learned to use recently is to take extra calories with me on the trail. I was out on a fast packing trip and I thought, oh, I can take enough calories for 15 miles, 15 miles worth of calories, but for 35 miles, when it ended up being 50 miles, then I got myself into some trouble. So yeah, since then I've been putting more calories in my pack, more than I think I need. It's also good training to have that extra weight in your pack. It's a win-win.
It's a small price to pay. A good investment, I would say.
I don't know how many times I have looked at the pack and decided, no, I don't need this. And they're ounces. And when you need it, you need it.
You do.
So
yeah.
Carry it. Yeah, it's worth it.
So, Candace, you are an ultra-sponsored athlete. What shoe are you running in currently? What's your choice of the day?
I just love the Superiors. They just came out with a new 2.5. They feel like they have, like, good trail claws on them. Really good traction.
Trail claws.
Yeah. No, that's nice. It's not big ones, but it's got a really good grip. And I really need that for the trails when I'm trying to run down a hill fast. You know, I want to really be able to fly. And these shoes, you feel really confident that you're going to have your feet stay where you plan to put them.
That's my next shoe, Scott, is the Superior 2.0 or 2.5. And that's and you might as well go 2.5 because it's got to be 0.5 better. And that is absolutely next. I'm in the Lone Peak right now. No complaints, but Billy Yang's running the Superior. I think we just talked to Josh Arthur. He's running in the Superior. And now Candace. So I need to get a pair of those.
Yeah, they're great.
We need to put in an order, Don. Let's save our pennies.
Well, go over to Trail Runner Nation, go to the partners page and click on over to Ultra Running Footwear and you will have yourself a pair within 2 days.
Be an ultra, ultra runner.
AudiblePodcast.com has been a great partner of Trail Runner Nation for a long time now, Don.
A long time, Scott. It's a wealth of information. It's like the modern day library.
What goes better than going out on a trail and taking a good book with you?
I don't think it. Well, maybe a good podcast, Scott, but a book comes in second.
You know, you can go to audiblepodcast.com and look at their many thousands and thousands of Audible books and download some. Some of them that we recommend. Matt Fitzgerald has a lot of his books on Audible. Diet Cults, we've talked to him about.
Matt's been a great guest and provides all kinds of great stuff. What else does he have there?
The 50-50. It's the story of Dean Karnazes running 50 marathons in 50 days.
That'd be a nice listen.
And one that I still have not listened to that I want to is Iron War. It's the story of Dave Scott and Mark Allen.
You haven't listened to that? Scott, that's a great story.
Have you?
Yes.
Well, anyway, you can get all of them. You can get one free if you go to audiblepodcast.com/TRN.
Ultra Running Magazine, probably the best journal in all of ultra running.
It's what I like to call a living Bible of ultra running.
Is that what you like to call it, Scott?
It's living because it's updated every month. Every month.
Well, and the thing I like about it most is the picture, Scott. I mean, we know that ultra running provides some of the best pictures, and I have never seen some of the views from my own couch at home that I've seen in Ultra Running Magazine.
I keep them around. I have like years and years of backlogged ultra running magazines because I like the pictures on the front cover.
Are you like one of those guys that just holds on to stuff?
I'm a hoarder.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you on this case.
I'm a hoarder. We have the July issue that's coming up that will be a good roundup of a lot of the summer races.
Scott, you know, it's kind of like a podcast on paper. That's Ultra Running Magazine. There's plenty of tips. There's experts that are providing information on how to and what to do and what not to do. So I like to think of Ultra Running Magazine as a podcast on paper.
And we've partnered with them where you can get $20 off annual subscriptions. So you're only paying $29.95 for an annual subscription, go to our partners page and click on the Ultra Running Magazine link.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Oh, come on. Don't put yourself down.
We are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
I can hear you, and you can hear me, and I look cool with this little thing hanging off my.
You do,
yeah.
There is definitely.
We're going to take a screenshot, and that's going to be the photo for the podcast.
Give me a gong for the mouthpiece thing. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
It's got to be louder than that.
Yeah.
Really? Don't be afraid to hit it.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Really? That loud?
Yeah. Well, maybe that was a bit aggressive.
Somewhere in between.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I'm going to say that was a 5. We're really looking for more in the 8s, okay? So that's about a 5. So,
okay. For the loud one was a 10?
The loud one was over the top. Yeah, it was an 11. Yeah,
that was an 11.
Hey, Andy, do you have any real direction you'd like to go with this podcast?
No.
Okay. How about you, Craig?
No.
Okay.
Whatever you want.
Scott?
You're going to fit in just right.
All right. So we are recording, just for the record. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
I'm Don Freeman.
Andy Jones Wilkins.
Craig Thornley.
And we're here on the we're here to talk about Western States course from the tap room.
Pre-race Western States podcast. We're what, 12 days out? 12 days out, we'll say.
Well, yeah.
And if we're not, we'll release the podcast late
accordingly. Hey, so we're here because we have Craig Thornley, race director, in studio. Scott and I are at the same table, and we have Andy Jones Wilkins in his tap room back in where are you located exactly in Virginia?
I'm back in Virginia in Charlottesville. I'm heading out west on Friday.
Awesome. So if you go to Google and you Google in tap room AJW, you will find that it has many positive Yelp reviews, all kinds of great brews there that he's serving up, and a positive rating by the Better Business Bureau, which I was surprised. Yeah, because I thought for sure he was going to be running from them, but not a chance. So Andy Jones, welcome to Trail Runner Nation, back to Trail Runner Nation, and thanks for inviting us into your tap room.
Great to be back again.
And these guys are not only icons with Western States. Craig's the race director now, but they have some finishes behind them. Between the two of them, I think what 18?
18, yeah.
18 finishes between the two of them, and some of them were
top teners.
Top 10 extended podium type stuff, right?
I don't know, AJW. How many top 10s did you have?
I can't remember anymore. I'm getting so damn old.
Well.
I think it was 7.
It was 7 in a row he got.
Oh. Yeah, he has it tattooed on his forearm.
Yeah. What do you mean you forgot?
Yeah.
So welcome. And so we want to talk a little bit about some projections. We have some amazing athletes coming this year, as always. It's a race that gets global attention to see who's who and who's running well. And many of the top athletes place their race season around this one event. So we want to turn the attention to it. We know AJW and Craig Thornley both follow the competition well. Scott and I, we love to listen to them talk about it. So that's what we'd like to do. But before we get into the top teners, let's talk about maybe one of the most important things about the race, and that's the course itself. So what kind of conditions do we expect this year? Everybody's projecting. I know there have been years that people have snow cams on watching to see how much snow's falling, what conditions look like, and so what
the snow the snow cams have been disabled.
Yeah,
they were disabled a couple years ago, right? And broken.
So tell us a little bit about what are your projections? What have you seen up there, Craig?
Well, there will be zero snow on the course. Mm.
So not a snow year.
I think April 1 average was like 3% of normal.
Ooh.
And April 1st. Yeah. So there's no snow.
And that was an April Fool's joke. It was actually 1%.
And it was getting really dry, but we've had some rain in the last week and a half or so. So it has taken down some of the dust. The swinging bridge is back.
Mm, that's good.
Last year we had to cross the North Fork and the Middle Fork.
Mm-hmm.
via cable. We're back to the full course. We've done quite a bit of trail work in Volcano Canyon and Deadwood Canyon, so the course will be fast. Mm-hmm.
And is it still pretty exposed with the fire that came through?
Yeah, there was a lot of logging to take out the trees from the American fire, so there's a little bit more exposure coming up Devil's Thumb. Yeah, it could be a little bit sunnier and warmer. Yeah.
So if the weather, which is this last week or so, continues, it could be a record-breaking hot.
It could be
summer.
Hot in there, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing happened to El Dorado Canyon though, so that canyon won't. There's a lot of shade in that canyon.
So let's talk. Let's bring that up and let's get Andy Jones to weigh in on this, and followed up by Craig on the evolution of this course. You know, a bit for the last few decades. What has changed? Because what I hear, like you said, the course is fast. Is it getting faster?
Yeah, I think if you asked Tweetmeyer, he would agree that it's probably, you know, 15 to 20 minutes faster than some of the older courses. Cavanaugh Ridge is no longer in the race. That was a rough section of trail between Robinson Flat and Deep Canyon,
mm-hmm.
which Deep Canyon's not on the course anymore. You come up out of Robinson Flat, climb up Little Bald Mountain, and then you basically scream downhill all the way to the Swinging Bridge. That's a really fast section.
So AJW, weigh in on the evolution of Western States and what it has mean to some of our finish times and some of our runners.
Well, I first want to definitely agree with Craig on that section. Once you top out at Little Bald, you know, when you wander over to the drier side there and you make that long, gradual, very runnable descent to Miller's Defeat and then pass Miller's Defeat to Dusty Corners and then Pucker Point. I think, you know, the trail work guys have really done a great job smoothing out, too, a lot of sections that used to be pretty gnarly. I know they get every year into Volcano and down on the descent to No Hands Bridge, but even those few years after the Star Fire, you know, when they brought the section of the course back in with Kin Canyon, it was really rough going through there, and now that's a lot smoother and faster as well. I'll say something else, too, about this year's race that I think important for people to understand. For the first time in a long time, the race has reduced a couple of aid stations for this year's running, which, frankly, could make times a little bit faster. There won't be an aid station at the escarpment. Craig, correct me if I'm wrong here. There won't be an aid station at the bottom of Bath Road. As you know, as you're coming out of Volcano Canyon and you hit the pavement, formerly there was a small aid station down there hosted by Auburn Running Company. That won't be there. They'll have to make it all the way up to Forest Hill. And then the entire river crossing complex will just be one large aid station rather than one on either side of the river. And while I'm not sure it'll have a tremendous impact on people's experience, if you've been running the race for in the past, you might notice that as a little bit difference. I think, by the way, that's a great change for the race to reduce the number, I believe, Craig, from 24 to 21.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
So let me ask the race director this. In the past, a crew could meet at the bottom of Bath Road and accompany the runner on up. Is that still allowed, or is that out now?
We're still allowing that.
Okay. Yeah. So they can they actually bring some fluid down there for them to climb out of the Bath Road?
They could. They can't mule for them, but yeah, they can. They can crew them. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
you can't carry the fluid up. You know, give them a bottle back and forth.
Understood. But you could refill a bottle for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because you've just come through some hot canyons at that point, and Bath Road isn't that long on training day, but on race day it can be a little longer.
Yeah. And another thing on possibly affecting the times is we're not weighing runners this year at any of the aid stations. You know, the research has shown that it's not a real good indicator of whether you should consume more fluids or not. And it was actually probably causing more people to become hyponatremic and over drink.
Right.
So we are not weighing. So in some of those earlier aid stations, you know, five or six of the top runners are there at the same time, bottlenecked at the scale. So it may have a little effect on the times, but probably not significant.
Well, speaking of bottleneck stuff and different years, what about the raft this year? Have you projected early on whether the river crossing is going to be by
foot?
Yeah,
you would think in a year of, what, fourth year in a row of drought or third year in a row of drought, yeah, that it wouldn't even be a question. But there's recreational releases from Oxbow all through the summer. They've cut them down to, it's either 4 or 5 days a week. So we still have that daily dump of water, mm-hmm, that goes up to about 1,100 CFS. But we have requested that the water is released earlier so the rafters can still float from the Middle Fork down to or from Oxbow on the Middle Fork down to Ruckachuck, but they just need to be done earlier. So we anticipate that everybody will be crossing on the cable like they did last year.
Yeah, I think that's the best way. You know, there isn't anybody waiting, and yeah, it's kind of iconic. You know, that view of people holding onto the cable.
A lot of photos.
Yeah, that's one of the best.
So we timed the release so that, you know, the first runners at 4:30 or so cross. But if someone shows up at 3:30, the water will not have dropped in time. So we've been dealing with these faster and faster times down at the river, which has made it a little bit more challenging.
Yeah,
to still allow all those rafters to get their full day of, you know, revenue in. Mm-hmm. If we could buy out all of the rafting permits, we would, but we're not there yet.
We'd have to raise the price of the race.
Yeah.
Andy, do you have a comment there?
Other than one of the things I'm most excited about going into this year's Western States, being that I'm not running it, is being a spectator, and my whole family's joining the party, including my oldest son, Carson, who's been coming to the race since he was an infant and is going to spend the better part of the day down at the river crossing. He's a river guy and loves whitewater kayaking and so forth, and he's going to be down there with the crew helping out in whatever way he can, and I think that'll be a real treat for him.
What are you going to be doing, AJW? What are you going to be doing all day?
You know, thanks for asking. I've Craig's been telling me for years that it's really fun to see the race from the other side, and I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to be around for the start up in Squaw, and then be quickly transported down to Net Control at Auburn Overlook, and be working in there. I've about a 5-hour shift scheduled to work in Net Control, which, from what I understand, requires a fair amount of communication work and shuttling between different people who are getting messages from the various aid stations. So I'll really see kind of the innards of the race, I think, for that first 5-hour period, or it'll actually be from hour 2 to hour 7. And then I'm going to head right down to Placer High School and work the finish line from the setup to breakdown, and be working with Mr. D down there, all in what I and John Mettinger and others call the happiest place on earth. I'll get a little inside experience of the happiest place on earth. Craig's invited me, and I've accepted the opportunity to interview the men's winner and the women's winner after they finish, which is will be a real treat. I had a chance to do that one other time in 2012 when I was injured. And then a couple more things. I'm going to do a shift in the announcer's booth when John Mettinger takes his annual nap. He after the excitement of all the 24-hour finishers, he goes off and takes a nap. And so I get to announce for 2 hours. And as you guys know, once the 24-hour period is passed, it's a bit of a lull there in the finishers. Craig assures me he's going to check in with the neighbors to make sure it's okay that this blasting, booming voice comes across. And then, if it allows, one of the things I've been fascinated to observe over the last few years is that the finishers during the golden hour, you know, from 29 to 30. And it's such a great experience to see these finishers come in. And not a lot of people know this, but one of the things Tim Tweetmeyer's done ever since he ran his 25th race in 2006 is he's thrown on his running stuff and run back up the course at about that time and caught up with the horse sweeps who are coming in literally behind the last runners. And if he'll let me, I might tag along with him and see what that experience is like in that last final hour as people are fighting the cutoffs to make it to Placer by 11 o'clock.
Hey, now, Andy, I want to back up to the radio station, the Overlook, Netcom?
Net Control.
So I would like
I like Netcom. I'll lobby to have that changed, Tom.
Well, Netcom. The man in the lobby is to your left. So over at Net Control, let me just explain to you that is more like a prison for you, Andy Jones Wilkes. what the race director is concerned is that you might strip off what clothes you have on, put on a pair of running shorts, and jump in the middle. After 10 completions at Western States, you may not be able to control yourself and want to get out there and run. So I think you're being held hostage there for a bit.
Oh, no, it's very clear, you know, and Craig, who's been such a wonderful friend and has come out to my my race here in Arizona, in Virginia the last 2 years, has said, you know, now that you're a race director, you really need to see what the underbelly of the race really looks like. And so, yeah, I think for him to send me into a dark room with a bunch of computer geeks and then down to a hot finish line for 7-8 hours, it's purgatory pretty much.
So I want to ask you, Craig, eight finishes for you, which is great. You're in a select list. What is the difference between being the runner and the race director? What surprised you? What was the most eye-opening? I didn't even realize that this was part of the race as race director. That's a completely different look.
Well, yeah, you told me I didn't need to prepare for this.
No, so you don't. This is spontaneous.
What surprised me the most? I think I've said this a couple times. The volume of emails of differing subjects. Hmm. When I interviewed, I heard, you know, 50 emails a day. Come on, I work in IT. You cannot scare me with the number of emails. But what surprised me was how many different balls are up in the air at the same time.
Yeah.
And you got to keep all of these going. Uh-huh. So you get these emails about different topics, and you got to totally context switch, and you can't ignore them. You can't take a day off of email. So has been surprising.
Are these emails from the organization part of it, or are they emails from participants that are
the first
have questions?
The first 2 years, it was the organization. It was volunteers, and many of them I wouldn't even know who they are or what they had done. You know, I've always done this in the past, and the race director hasn't contacted me yet.
Uh-huh.
Well, I didn't even know what you did. I don't know who you are. I've got a handle on the infrastructure a little better because I've set up more of a delegation model.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to handle, I don't have to talk to or communicate with 1,500 volunteers.
And that's how many, 1,500?
Yeah, it's somewhere around there, 1,500
wow.
or 1,600. So I got a handle on that, but we still get the media inquiry, the, you know, spectator inquiries. It's getting better.
Good.
But
AJW, what do you expect to see on that smooth underbelly?
I have a feeling I'm going to be, my eyes are going to be open to the incredible complexity of this whole thing. You know, and I've seen it a little bit hanging around Craig over the last few years before and after the race. And the other folks that he has doing things, whether it be his start-finish crew or the opening packet pickup or the various, the magnitude of, for example, the pre-race briefing. I mean, these are things you have at all races. They're just on absolute steroids at Western States. And I think the complexity and the challenge of putting on the event is going to be something that's going to be really eye-opening. I have to admit, until maybe my sixth or seventh finish, I took that stuff for granted because all I had to do was run. And frankly, even though the runners probably don't want to hear this, running's the easy part of this event. It really is.
Yeah, and you guys said he's going to be in purgatory that day. He's actually going to know what's going on with the event better than he ever has in any other capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Have a better appreciation.
It's the hub of all of the information.
Right? Yeah.
He'll know any problems that are coming up. He'll know where every runner is, or he'll have that at his fingertips.
You know, let's talk about that. The net.
Called it Netcom, but it's Net Control.
Net Control.
And I've been in there.
I'm already started to call it Netcom.
No.
But Net Control, how many people are involved in
the communications aspect of Western States?
Well, there's the on WSTrail.org, the whole comm assignments are available to the public if you want to look at it. It's probably around, I don't know, 60 to 100 ham radio operators. But net control is not just the ham radio operators. We have the webcast team too. So there's another three or four at a time, you know, throughout the 30 hours. There's a bunch of shifts. And then we have someone that we refer to as RD2. There's four different people that are capable of making decisions on my behalf and solving problems that, you know, I don't even have to know about. If a gate's not open, or if we have problems with public or a variety
markings
of
or anything.
Anything. And we did some training last year. That was one of the infrastructure changes that I've made is we've gone over different scenarios. Like, what happens if we have a fire in the state area during the middle of the race?
Yeah.
You know, and they alert.
I never thought of that.
What do we do? And there's a lot of written protocols that my predecessor, you know, he did a lot of codification. So we get to use the protocols that were already written, but you still got to think about them and anticipate, well, what do we do? You know, if there is a serious injury on the course, what do we do? AJW get to see that.
Yeah.
In addition, he's going to be helping with the webcast team. And often, numbers to the ham radio operators who are not necessarily runners, they're just numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Bib numbers don't really mean anything to a lot of these people, but they do to Andy, right? He'll mm-hmm. know that, okay, there's a woman in the lead at Robinson Flat. That's probably not right.
Right.
Yeah.
No. So that kind of knowledge is actually going to be very useful.
Since Ann's not running.
But that kind of thing. Or maybe something that's not possible. Like they ran a 32-minute split from Duncan Canyon to Robinson Flat. Like, no.
Yeah.
That's not possible.
So good trail knowledge.
And so you go back and say, well, are you sure that was bib number blah blah blah? Yeah, it was that bib number. Well, that can't be right.
Now, one of the lures of Western States is it's so hard to get into. I mean, I remember back not too long ago that you had a 1 in 3 chance of getting in, or, you know, 2-time loser, you'd get to go in the next third time. But it's certainly different than that now. And I know one of the things that Western States tries to do is make it fair for everyone to get in. And just because you carry a large name doesn't necessarily mean that you can enter anytime you want, or at least that's been my understanding of looking into it. Is that true?
A large name? What do you mean by that?
Well, say Killian or one of the...
This is not a race of champions. It's not the best of the best from around the globe all congregating at one place. I mean, the top 20, I mean, they're pretty talented.
We have avenues for elite athletes to gain entry outside of the lottery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. UTWT, there's six foreign spots.
So with that said, are there any athletes that are hoping to get in or wanting to get in that just can't get through one of those avenues, or it's pretty much performance based, and if you really want to go, you can find a race or find an avenue and apply your skill set and get in.
you gotta study it. Mm-hmm. We had some confusion over the UTWT spots being allocated to foreign runners. We had an American runner who thought he could get in via the UTWT spots, and we've never let in American runners through UTWT. That the avenue for American runners, elite American runners, is the Montreal Ultra Cup.
Mm-hmm.
The UTWT is for foreign entrants, those who can't come and run Lake Sonoma or Bandera mm-hmm. without considerable expense to fly across the ocean. And
mm-hmm.
So if you study how you can get in,
and you're fast,
you can find a way to get in.
Good.
Let's talk about the racers this year. The docket of racers. How does the international field look compared to past years? Do we have more international racers this year?
I think this is our deepest international field that we've ever had. The UTWT has helped, but we also let in a few before the lottery. You know, we used to do the foreign consideration. Mm-hmm. You remember we used to let the first 25 foreign applicants in. We've trimmed that down, and we let in a couple of foreign elites this year, Francois Dehaene, Julien Chaurier, and we let in one other. Who did we let in? Jedah Demas Grinius from Lithuania.
Oh yeah,
we let in those guys through foreign consideration, and then the UTWT spots, Tomas Lorblanchet, Andrew Tukey from Australia, and Cyril Contre from France, plus the top 10. This is just men now. The top 10 foreigners, Ryan Sands, mm-hmm. and then let's see, who was the other? There was one other foreigner.
The Aussie guy, Davies.
Yeah, Brendan Davies.
Yep.
So the men's foreign contingent is as deep as I've seen it. I don't know about what you recall, Andy, but
oh no, it's definitely as deep. It's and I think we've seen that trend since 2010. What was it? That year we had 14 runners all under 17 hours. Or was that 2011? What was the year we didn't go to Robinson Flat? Was that 10 or 11?
I don't recall right now.
It was just packed with international runners. I think of the 14, seven, if you count Canadians, seven or eight were international. That trend has just continued. And I want to just go back, if I may, to the avenues in, because on the domestic side, I've been thrilled just as a fan the way in which the Montreal Ultra Cup has worked this year to truly be and provide that avenue in. As Craig said, if they've studied and they found the race, with the exception of Lake Sonoma 50, it was all 100K races this year. And there were some wonderful stories of experienced Western States veterans who have wanted another crack at the race, who've used the Montreal Ultra Cup as a way in. And I'm thinking specifically of a previous winner on the women's side, Anita Ortiz, a longtime successful previous Ultra Runner of the Year, Jorge Pacheco, and most of all, and sadly, of course, he won't be able to compete this year due to his tragic leg injury, but Dave Mackey, in his mid-40s, went out to Arizona and just got himself in shape and got himself a spot through the Montreal Ultra Cup in a 100K race. It was just so great to see that happening. For years there have been criticism, I believe, not fairly levied against the race because of what seemed to be special deals to special people. Just absolutely not the case. And when you see these people this year, here they are in the braving the winter in Boulder, Colorado, in the case of Dave and Anita, getting their spots and punching their tickets. That's what the Ultra Cup's for. So if you think you're fast and you think you deserve a spot, there's no, and you can afford a plane ticket to get to Arizona or California or wherever, the spots are there for the taking.
And there's quite a few first time 100 milers that got their spot via the Montreal Ultra Cup, including Magdalena Boulay. Mm.
That's right.
Which is going to be really exciting.
Fun to watch. Yeah.
226 marathoner, Olympian. Pretty awesome. Ryan Bach, who was he was an OTC elite athlete, mm-hmm. track athlete up in Eugene. I used to watch him run on Hayward Field, uh-huh. when I lived up there. So there's quite a few. That is really exciting too, to see these newer, inexperienced 100-mile runners who are very talented.
Like Alex Varner last year.
Alex Varner last year, his
inauguration into the ultra world, and what did he finish
in
like
seven?
Fifth?
He was seventh.
So I really like how you have balanced out fairness to those of us that aren't elite runners, and those that want to weigh in. You've provided avenues, and I think that's a nice evolution of entry into Western States.
And I think it's very transparent too. I mean, you can go onto the website and you can find out how each of those runners got in.
Yeah, full disclosure. Yeah, you can't sneak anybody in this thing. There are eyes all over those spreadsheets.
Yeah, and as I said at the lottery, we're not going to hide anything. You may not like how we let people in, but we're not going to hide how we let people in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. How many runners are running this year, Craig?
Well, we have 388 entrants, and I think there right now there's five or six that have already said that they're not going to run. My goal with the Forest Service was 366 starters this year.
So it kind of walk us through that, and either one of you can, because I'm sure that you both know. The deal or the goal is to have a certain number of runners over a period of time. So if there's a lot of drops, you get to increase.
Yeah. So the attrition rate or the DNS rate, same.
Okay.
Same meaning.
Did not start.
I use attrition rate when I talk to the Forest Service. You know, historically it's been somewhere around 10%. Mm-hmm. Last year was 5.8%. Mm. So we overbook like airlines do. Mm-hmm. You have to guess how many seats you're going to have.
Right? Yeah, right.
So that is really challenging when the attrition rate is changing on you.
Uh-huh.
But in 1984, the Granite Chief Wilderness was created, and after 4 years of legal wrangling, we were grandfathered in and allowed to have the same number of starters as we had in 1984 before the wilderness area was created. So they give us a 5 year rolling average to meet that 369. So we're constantly trying to you know, change the number of people we let in to get to that 369. And we're a little bit over right now. The way averages work, we had a zero in 2008.
Right.
So when that zero is in the five-year rolling average, you're really low.
Yeah.
Well, that zero fell out. So the years after the fire where there was some compensation to let in people that were, you know, the demand just was backed up. Mm-hmm. So when that zero fell out, the average was higher. So we're trying to correct from that.
Hey, we failed to mention an important guest on here. Certainly, Craig and AJW here, but we also have the gong and perhaps Andy, you could go ahead and hit that gong, Craig.
At an eight level?
At an eight, yeah. Okay, that's perfect.
There we go. Yeah.
So, Andy, tell us about the gong and when we should apply it and use it, because we want to make sure that we do as we move through some of these entrants and the discussion as it rolls forward. Pace is important, gentlemen. We want to make sure that we don't do any too much interval work, and we don't want to do any walking if possible.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, number one, the gong goes off if you say something stupid, especially if Scotty does.
Every time I open my mouth.
Yeah, and then there you go. Get it right now. There it is. And then it also goes off if there's something that's particularly important and poignant, and we want to, you know, emphasize the importance of it, you know. For example, if somebody were to say, Craig Thornley is the most incredible race director in the world. There you go.
So there's really no rhyme or reason to the gong.
There's really no rules.
Okay. So you can't go wrong, Craig, over there if you strike the gong.
Unless I hit it 11.
Yeah. Don't go at 11 on
11
the gong.
Level.
Okay. So shall we start with Andy Jones-Wilkins? Why don't you lead us through this and talk to us a little bit about what you expect, what you think is going to happen this year?
All right. Well, I'm going to start on the women's side.
Very good.
That's
a change.
I think I'm fascinated by what I think would be an interesting battle at the front with last year's winner, Stephanie Howe, whose training has just been on target and had a great race last year, really did everything right. And one of the women that Craig just mentioned who got in through the cup and is a first-time 100-miler, Magdalena Boulay. I think, I'd have to put those two runners in the mix for, being there in the end. It's going to be, there's many others, of course, that'll be battling for spots, but those two seem to be at the top of the list. And then there's a great story in the back, well, possibly in the middle of the top 10 with Nikki Kimball, who's coming back to finish her 10th Western States. She is extremely excited about it. I've talked to her several times. She's going to be on our Western States Veterans panel on Thursday before the race, which I'm thrilled about. And she has the potential of being a 10-time top tenner, were she to find her way into the top 10. And if the trends of hot temperatures keep going up, I think she has a real good shot at that, and likely to finish her ninth top 10, the ageless one, Megan Arbogast.
She's incredible.
She's incredible.
She's all right.
That was Craig, Megan.
Yeah.
If I had the gong, I'd be gonging her right now, because that's a very sarcastic.
We train together.
Yeah. Craig, who am I missing there on the women's side that ought to?
Michelle Yates probably should get a
mention. Oh, yeah, Michelle Yates.
Runner of the year 2 years ago. And Eliza LaPierre. And then, of course, 9 out of the 10 top 10 women are back.
Have we talked about Don's run-in with Eliza?
Oh, you know, I could tell I'll tell a quick story, my story. Eliza LaPierre, Paul Terranova story. So I run with Lee McKinley up here, and we're going to go run one of the Memorial Day Western States training run from Robinson down to Forest Hill. And he says, hey, I've got some friends from out of town that are staying, and they'd like to ride up with us to Robinson, because we didn't get our bus ticket or something, Craig, so it didn't work out for us. So we're appropriately placed. Thank you very much. And so I said, oh, yeah, we've got room. That'd be no problem. And so I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm with Lee McKinley. He's a pretty sharp runner, and I was in better shape at the time. And so, heck, we're pretty decent runners. I wonder who these people are that are coming up with us. And so I ask, well, how did you get into the race? And Paul says, Eliza got in because she was a top tenner last year. I went, oh. And then I find out that it's Paul Terranova, and I go, oh. So I started out running with them. And then when they said, hey, we're going to go check out and see what's up ahead. Now, that's a real nice way of saying,
I'm going to leave you in the dust.
You're a little slow for us, Freeman, who thought you were all high and mighty back there in the Jeep driving us up here.
We're grateful for the ride, but we need to be back before sundown.
We're going to go check and see what's up ahead. All right. Thank you very much. So tell me how rare a 10 top 10 finisher is. I mean, that sounds like there's not too many names that share that distinction.
Well, the one that's at the top of the list is long-time Craig, help me here.
Doug Latimer.
Oh, Doug Latimer.
Ann Trason, mm-hmm. Bjorg Osterheim Smith, I believe, would mm-hmm. be the three that come to mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, don't forget Tim Tweetmeyer, 15 top fives.
Yeah, but
so you know that's
first,
a whole different.
But the first 10, ballgame. And you know the first 10 is what I thought we were doing.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
And boy, Tim sure dominated for a long time. He's iconic in the sport. What do you think his secret was? And is for being such an outstanding performer.
Did you see pictures this weekend from the camp out?
No.
I think it's his attire.
Will you post his attire, Scott?
Did you see that?
I'll find
he
photos.
He had a beater from 19 something early.
Uh huh.
And it just looked pathetic.
Was it dirty?
No, I don't think he's worn it at all.
Oh, okay.
I'll weigh in on a little bit more serious note. I think his training was just perfect. He focused on one race a year. Craig has showed me, his training logs. He was not an insane mileage guy. He trained specifically for the courses that he was running on. Being a big guy, he knew his strengths, you know, were in the downhills. Which, as you know, if you can run downhills in Western States, you're gonna do well. And he never wavered. He also had an absolute engineer's mind for executing his race plan perfectly. You know, even as changes came into the sport, like the way in which we access nutrition or the way in which we access fluids, he was meticulous in his preparation and his execution. I think he's a role model to everybody who's running long distances these days.
Are you trying to get a spot in the race?
No.
So, AJW, I got to share something with you. You guys are familiar with the ice cream sandwich run?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a Tim Tweetmeyer classic. This is one of the things that made him really, really good at Western States, is he learned and created ways to train specifically for Western States. The ice cream sandwich run, you start at Cal 2, which is mile 70.
Uh-huh.
You run backwards up the course to the swinging bridge, turn around.
And how far is that to the swinging bridge, for those that are listening that may not know?
From the cul-de-sac, it's 26 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then you turn around, you start running back, and you stop at Forest Hill, eat an ice cream sandwich, and chase it with a soda. And then you got to run fast to Cal 2, which is you got to run 115 to Cal 2 without puking.
Well, and that's
so you got a belly full of fluid and ice cream sandwich, and then you run hard. And it's simulated, coming to the aid station, you know, putting a lot of food in there, and then racing. And AJW, he told us on Friday night that it's supposed to be a 20-ounce soda.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's what I said. So technically, we have never done an ice cream sandwich. We've never
completed
an ice cream. Yes.
All those workouts don't count.
I think he's misremembering because when he was winning way back in the day.
They didn't have 20-ounce sodas.
Exactly. They didn't have 20-ounce sodas.
They had cans.
But he was adamant that he was right. So,
It hurts. I'm embarrassed to say I failed my last ice cream sandwich.
I think we have that in the archives of podcasts.
I failed it. I puked at the top of the elevator shaft, and I didn't make it. I failed it twice. A, I puked at the top of the elevator shaft, and B, I didn't make it in 75 minutes. So I went to Tweetmeyer. He's like, sorry, you didn't do the workout.
You have to scratch it from your log.
It didn't happen.
Count any of it. That's tough business. You
zero.
Know, he's not easy.
Not easy. No.
So is this run done traditionally on a certain day? Is it not? I believe you guys are
pretty
traditional.
Well, the Oregonians started doing it at the end of our 10-day training camp that we'd have at Michigan Bluff every year. But Tweet did it many times in the year.
Yeah. But course specific training. How important is that?
Let me just give you an idea of how hard Tweet is on people. It was a year that Craig had a particularly tough time. I think he was a couple hours behind me, and I was asleep at the finish line.
That's a gong.
AJW, that was mean.
Hey, AJW, the story still works. The story still works without saying that he was behind you by 2 hours, okay?
Well, no, but it was just funny because he got in. I wasn't being hard. I'm telling you what Tweet did, not what I did.
All right.
So Tweet, he gets to the finish line. He finally crosses it. Tweet gives him his medal, and he's like, what took you so long, Craig?
Ouch.
Yeah, right there in front of everybody, the cameras and his fans, he can dish it.
Hey, I want to get you guys know Megan really well. Let's talk about her performance as an athlete. She's 50. Well, we shouldn't talk
54.
About her age, but we will.
It's on ultrasound.
She's proud of it.
54, and she has 8 top 10 finishes, going for her 9th.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
How does she do that? Yes. And you train with her.
There's a couple things that I think that she did right. She was coached
by Warren Fink. She had good parents.
She has good genes. But she was coached by Warren Fink in her early years, and he wouldn't let her race very often at all. One marathon a year, one ultra a year. So she was really under-raced when her husband died 4 or 5 years ago. That's when she kind of just unleashed. She got rid of the coach. She changed coaches, and she started racing, every 2 months, different distances. But I think being held back early in her career helped her or allowed her to be as productive and prolific as she is right now. Many of us race, and the new runners now, the new fast folks are racing a lot.
Mm-hmm. Every other weekend.
And Megan didn't do that. The other thing that I think she does that I know I don't do is she spends so much time on her body and her biomechanics. She had a PT, especially when she lived in Eugene, or she lived in Corvallis. She would come to a PT in Eugene and, you know, they'd work on some minor, what I thought would be minor, you know. And she just has this perfect stride, and whenever anything isn't right, she fixes it. And
Wow.
You know, most of us don't do that.
Yeah, yeah.
How important is that?
I mean, put some ice on it and maybe pop some vitamin I and and just hope it goes away. No.
You know, we talk about that a lot on this podcast about how important biomechanics are and gait are in running. But that's just a great example of how it can make you run at that level for that long.
And stay healthy.
And if you look at her races, that 100K that she just ran where she was the first American female, eighth overall, they had live cameras. And her stride just does not deteriorate. It looks the same in the first 5K as it does at 95K.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So
you train with her. I mean, does she do warm-up exercises, gait exercises before you guys go out on a run?
Not extensively, no.
Okay.
No, it's normal warm-up.
Okay.
Nothing too crazy.
Hey, AJW, I want to call your attention to the Kevin Sawchuk rule. Do you recall us talking about that? Maybe you
the seven-year rule. Yeah.
Let's wrap that. Let's make it even more official, even though Kevin's not here, and relate it to Megan. What do you think? There's a correlation or a connection there?
No, I think she's defying it a little. I mean, I think Craig's point is a good one about that she was unleashed relatively late in her career to do what she's doing right now. I think she could last longer than 7 years. Just because of her efficiency and that she's not falling apart and that she takes care of her body. I got to say, in these last 2 years when I've run in the same general area as her at Western States, I'm so, so impressed with, you know, it's a cliche, but how she runs her own race. She doesn't worry about who's in front. I mean, maybe she does by the end, but going through the high country, if she needs to take a little extra time at the aid station, she's going to. If she needs to stop and get a rock out of her shoe or take a nature break, she does it. If there's people around her and she wants to chit-chat and talk with them, but she is running her own race from the start. And it was it's been fascinating for me to observe that over especially these last 2 years. It's one thing to say, oh, I'm going to just go out and run my own race, but it's another thing to actually do it. And I've seen her do it, and it's admirable.
I need to be gonged for not asking AJW to define the seven-year thank you, the 7 year rule.
Sorry,
from Kevin. What exactly is that?
Yeah, as we've talked about here before, and I think we talked about this a little bit with Ian Torrance in January, this notion of Sawchuk's kind of unscientific study of ultramarathon runners, that they really have seven good, strong, high-end years to sort of empty the tank, that you can, and that after those 7 years, you have diminishing returns, or in the worst case, you just kind of drop off the planet and you leave the sport. I haven't done any more scientific study than that. I will say that, you know, because I am a bit of a obsessive about Western States and being in the top 10 at Western States, if you look at the top 10 of Western States from year to year, there's people coming and going often. And going into this year's race, you know, there are only a few, as we've mentioned, talking about Nikki and Megan on the women's side and Ian Sharman on the men's side will be going for his sixth consecutive top 10. But other than that, you know, two or three top 10s people tend to drift off to other things. It's pretty interesting to look at.
Now, I have a lot of respect for Kevin. He's one of our medical captains at Michigan Bluff.
Yeah.
But isn't this the same guy who told us that he tastes his own urine to determine his salt content? Andy, do you remember that?
Same.
Yeah. The same Kevin.
Yeah,
okay.
He's the same Kevin. That deserves a gong.
A double gong. That's the first ever double gong, but I think certainly deserving, don't you?
Yeah. And what did you say, Andy, after he said that? Do you remember?
Craig, I can't remember.
You said that's not the responsibility of the pacer. It was very well timed, very well played.
Let's get into the men's field.
Yes. Well, can I mention something about Kevin since we're on that topic? And
when are we going to get him on the show? We keep on saying we need to get him on the show.
And so he is your aid station medical
captain at Michigan Bluff.
And I had a very, very rough time my last Western States. And came in there I had a good hour to try to come up with an excuse coming up that hill for me because I wasn't doing well. And so I thought, of every valid
excuse that I could deliver to Kevin or whomever I needed to try to appeal my story. And I gave him all of my excuses, and you know what he said? None of those are good enough. Get out there and go. But he did give me a piece of good advice. He says, if you feel
taste your urine?
No. He says, if you feel like you need to stop, then stop running, but doggone it, walk to that next aid station and then decide whether you're going to quit or not. If you don't feel you can run.
He got me on my knees this year because I rolled in there and he was wearing his 10-day buckle and I was 45 miles away from mine. And he comes in and his finger he has rubber gloves on and he raises his finger. He goes, did someone call for a rectal exam? Oh, hilarious.
Hey,
hilarious.
If it's an annual.
It cost me a couple minutes at the aid station, but that's okay.
Did he give you a clean bill of health?
Yeah, he said it was a little warm up there, but that's Western States.
One more thing about Kevin. He ran the race 10 times and yeah. he made a pledge that when he finished his 10, he was going to give back at least 10 years.
Oh, nice.
And he's on that on that quest, so.
From up there at the top of Roby, I know
we'll
this.
We'll see if AJW can do the same thing.
That's well. I distinctly remember his speech after he got his 10th, and I said, "You know what? If I ever get my 10th, I want to do the same thing." So I'm going into year one volunteering.
Year one for 10.
Not yet.
It's not over.
Not yet.
Yeah.
There's no gimme.
So I know this about Kevin. He places a set of stones or something at the top of Roby right before you turn right and it becomes a road, right at the change from trail to road. And he stacks some rocks there before the race and he runs towards that. And that provides him a draw or energy, kind of a subconscious thing. And I think that was kind of a cool thing that's kind of a little insider. Mm-hmm.
I do know that on Cal Street there's a tree that has a burl. And he moons the burl tree every time he goes by there. Remember that, AJW?
I do. And, I mean, this is great. He also, going through Pucker Point at Screw Auger Canyon, he always stops and takes a pee and draws an arrow in the dust with his pee pointing to Screw Auger Canyon.
Well, it's dry by the time I get there, so I never get to see it. It's fast.
I thought I knew this course, and I'm hearing names of places on this course I've never heard of before.
You don't know your split at the Burl Tree?
I don't.
Well, good. We need to get Kevin on here to defend some of these some of these comments.
Yes, we should get him on. That'd be fine.
With a tall glass of urine. From the tap room. From AJW's tap room.
I don't know what the technique. I mean, there must be a technique to tasting. Do you swirl and spit? Do you swallow? I mean, what is the proper...
How do you get it in your mouth?
He put it on a he put a drop on his finger and then he tasted it.
Have you seen this?
No, I haven't. But he told us.
It's just hearsay.
No, he told us.
It was a room full of 300 weekend. People, guys. It was.
It was.
This is well known. This is super inside.
I think it's recorded. There's an iRunFar video of it. There is.
Yeah. Speaking of iRunFar, I know AJW is all over that with the tap room. Great articles. Please go to iRunFar and check that out and see some of his predictions, see some of his comments, and he shares his wealth of knowledge in trail and his passion over at iRunFar. So it's a great resource. Well done, Andy Jones. Welcome.
Thanks. And this Friday I've got one more Western States piece that I'm going to write about this golden hour, the 30-hour finishers and the history of some of the real close calls people have had. I gotta say, it's an amazing thing to watch those folks come down the road with just a few minutes to spare.
Awesome. Well, thanks for doing that. Shall we gong and move to the men?
Sure.
Yeah.
That was a pretty weak gong.
Sorry. Okay, we're trying.
That's perfect. That was good. That's well done.
Sorry.
AJ, will you take us down the road for the men's top predictions and honorable mentions?
Well, yeah, I'm gonna say it's Rob Krar at the top of my list. I think he'd had a little bit of a hiccup at Lake Sonoma, but he came out to Auburn, a couple weeks later and just scorched that Canyons race out there. I think he's focused and ready and respects the distance, respects the race, respects the competitors. He's going to be on his A game, I believe, when he gets to Squaw. He's going to have his work cut out for him with Ryan Sands, who's been to the race a couple of times and been as close as second place in the Timothy Olsen's record breaking year, with Dylan Bauman, who continues to improve and is smart about his training and his racing. He's not over racing. He's learning from the people around him. I think that group of top three guys are going to be toward the front. The rest of last year's top 10, I think, will make interesting storyline, as well as, you know, what we opened with, some of these folks who've come in through the UTWT, Francois Dehaene, the big mountain races out in Europe. He's just owned them. And I think you got to imagine he's coming to Western States with a win in mind, as is Thomas Lorblanchet, who won Leadville. I think it's as deep as it's been, and it's going to be fun to watch from the comfort of the Auburn Overlook net control.
It is air-conditioned.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that it is really pleasant in there.
Nice, that's cool.
And you'll have pizza. It'll be good.
Nice.
Donuts in the morning, pizza at lunch.
Do you find that the international competitors that come over to run Western States the first time have as much difficulty, and maybe this is not an unfair comparison, have as much difficulty as Americans going over and running some of the international races like Ultra Trail de Mont Blanc?
Some of the same challenges,
yeah,
with different, just the way races are set up and run.
Yeah.
Do you want to touch it, AJW?
Well, I think I will a little bit, Craig, then you could elaborate. I think we got an interesting lesson on that with Killian. The first year Killian Jornet was over here and finished third at Western States, having, you know, some pretty bad dehydration issues. I'm not sure that was a mistake of it being the United States and not the Pyrenees. I think it was just a heat and adapting to the heat and the conditions on race day. I think we've seen great success from people like Tsuyoshi Kaburagi right out of the gate, Jez Bragg right out of the gate, you know, in their first time over here. Having not raced myself in Europe, but spoken a fair amount, particularly to people who've gone to UTMB, you know, the magnitude of that race and the challenge of that race, I think, has been an interesting one. And it has, I think, taken some American runners a couple of times going over there to get used to it. But, you know, I'd say five years ago, I was perhaps a lot more caustic about this. And I'd say, oh, Euro could never finish this race first time. I don't believe that anymore. Just like I don't believe that you have to have run 100 before to have had success at Western States. I do think first time 100 milers can succeed at the distance, depending on how things play out for them on the race day. So, I think this year, with a particularly large international field, it'll be particularly interesting to see how it plays out for both of those groups.
Yeah, I think that the two factors of Western States, it doesn't matter where you're from, but the speed at which you have to run, especially from Forest Hill in, and the heat, mm-hmm. those two factors combined, if you haven't raced in those conditions or trained in those conditions, it really doesn't matter where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
Those are hard, you know. And at the North Face Australia that Debo Francois was quoted as saying, once Debo started putting the hammer down, he said, "Is this how fast you guys run at Western States? This is too fast for me." Right? Give him another big 10,000 feet of climbing, and as it said in I Run Far.
Yeah.
Preview today,
right?
You know, and he'd probably prevail, but you got to start running, you know, 6:30 miles or so, 6 minute miles. It's a different race, different type of race.
And that's what some of those guys are running up front, coming through some of those faster stretches.
Yes,
there's a lot of turnover.
Yes,
wow, it's incredible. As I look at my GPS, look at my minute time out there, I think about some of those guys, and I'm thinking they are really flying out there.
Mm-hmm.
The only way I go that fast is if I accidentally step off the trail and fall down the canyon as I'm rolling down
to
the river.
That deserves a gong. That was good, Scott.
Well,
well stated. So
for another trick that Megan uses is she just leaves her Garmin on and then she gets in her car after the run. Your average pace.
I am going to have to try that. Yeah,
and then post
it. I'm going to post it to Strava.
You got to kind of make sure you're not on a highway or something. You know, don't make it too unbelievable.
Hey, so from 18 finishes between you two guys, what piece of advice would you give for a runner at the start line coming down into Placer High? What golden nugget or piece of information would you want them to carry with them?
My old standby will be that you're going to have trouble with your stomach. You're going to have issues with your quads, and you may end up getting trashed feet. But don't let those three things make you stop. You may need to rest at an aid station if you're puking and get your nutrition dialed in. You may need to sit on the massage table for a little while at Michigan Bluff and have people work on your quads. You may need to change your socks and get someone to tape up your feet and pop some blisters. But don't let those three things, that what I call the holy trinity of ultra running, don't let those three things bring you down. There's other things that can bring you down for sure, but don't let those, and go in with that mindset before the race even starts. Know that that's going to happen. Because I think even after all these years, some people are still surprised. They say, my gosh, I never get stomach issues in training. You know, I never get blisters. I've never had a blister in my life, and now I have 30 on my feet. You need to go in prepared for it. Just saying, it's going to happen. I'm probably going to puke. I am going to have trashed quads. Just keep going through that stuff.
Great advice. Craig, anything to add?
Yeah, and this will, I think, go well with AJWs. You know, we have 1,500 volunteers out there, 21 aid stations, and everybody wants to see you finish. Mm-hmm. Everybody is doing all they can to encourage you and motivate you and get you out of your low points. But only you know if you're in a position where you shouldn't continue. Mm-hmm. Only run to your training. And if it's not your day, it's okay to stop. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see anybody in the hospital at Auburn Faith on Sunday. I don't want to do any visits, no hospital visits. And the only way that we can prevent that is every single person has to, you know, determine for themselves, is this good for me? Should I stop?
Mm-hmm. So I heard two sides of the coin. I heard a cautious race director asking for people not to be helicoptered out of a canyon. So I get that. And I hear AJW's side, which is, hey, don't let a pain or something that feels uncomfortable break your whole day. So
yeah, let me be careful though. I also want to say I'm not saying by mentioning these three things, I'm not by any means saying finish at all costs.
Right.
So I'm in agreement with Craig. The other thing I'm in agreement with him though is on these volunteers. You know, I think particularly one of the aid stations where oftentimes people are really struggling and suffering and can use a little pick-me-up is at Devil's Thumb. You know, this is Dennis Zyloff's aid station. There are some of the nicest people in the world at Devil's Thumb. And as Craig said, every single one of them want to see you finish. Someone will meet you there. They will fill your bottles. They will ask you how you're doing. If you say you're feeling terrible, they will say, well, why don't you come over here and get a cold towel and have a sponge and maybe sit down for a little while. You've just come up that heinous climb out of Deadwood Canyon. They're there to serve you. You know, and you're 53 miles from the finish. You can really take care of yourself there, have other people take care of you. You can spend some time there. You can regroup and you can get it done. So, now, obviously, if things are really spinning out of control, you should know it. I mean, this is one of the nice things I think about the not doing the weighing as much. You know, they're not. You can do it optionally, I suppose, but you don't have to weigh. That you really have to make your own decision about whether or not you're going to continue. And trust me, if people were 7, 8, 10% down in weight they would probably feel like they were too. And so you would be able to either regroup from that or not.
I typically run with a scale. You know,
it's doesn't your GPS watch weigh you? Your new one, the new one, the new Garmin?
Yeah, it's not out yet. It's,
you know, I was going to say the year I ran Western States was one of the most amazing, electrifying atmospheres I've ever been a part of. And I think that was because of the volunteers. I know it is. I mean, because you come into those aid stations, and yeah, an aid station could be an aid station, can be an aid station, but at Western States, it's different. Those volunteers are, you know, rooting for you.
They take ownership of their aid stations.
They do.
That is, I mean, you could not take them away from that job.
And they'll take off their shirt and give it to you if they
would.
Need to.
Yeah.
They'll take.
I've got to say,
they would.
I look forward every year getting the last chance. So the aid station mile 43 before you descend into the canyon I was just talking about. And Craig, what's the club that does last chance? Stevens Creek Striders.
Stevens Creek. Yep.
Stevens Creek. And a lot of aid stations do this, but a person would walk right up to me, take my bottles, look me in the eye, introduce themselves, tell me their name, and say, I'm here to do anything. I'll do anything for you for the entirety of your time here in the aid station. They would walk me to the table, make sure my bottles got full, ask what kind of food I wanted, and then would walk out of the aid station with me each and every time. If I was drinking a cup of something, I could hand them the cup when I finished. They would take care of the trash. I could take the nasty goo packs out of my pocket and just give them to them, and the guy or gal would just take them. I probably had 6 or 7 different of these volunteers in my time at Western States. I always remembered the 60 to 90 seconds I spent with that one last chance volunteer who just like made my life a little bit better for a minute and a half as I was making my way from Squaw to Auburn. It's just amazing how that happens. And then you get up to Forest Hill and you feel like you're coming into the town. It's like the 4th of July parade is going on, you know. It's just amazing.
It is. That's been my experience too, Scott. I see you had something to say.
No, I was just going to say we're 12 days out. Even if we're not, we're going to say we're 12 days out.
We are 12. I verified.
Okay,
we're 12.
Okay, see, I did math. We're 12 days out. Two guys that have run Western States many, many times, and we may have one or two people that are actually listening to this podcast that are racing in 12 days. What advice do you give them for a taper? 12 days out. What do you suggest?
Well, do not stop stimulating your quads. Mm. Don't just rest the quads. I would still do something this weekend the week before the race to make sure you do some downhill to stimulate your quads.
So don't let them detrain. Some intensity is what you're talking about.
Yeah, don't detrain totally.
Okay.
Short, but downhill.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to concur with the downhill. I would also say keep full steam ahead on the heat training through whatever whether you're going out for midday jogs with a couple layers, or you're hitting the sauna for 45 minutes to an hour, or you live in a place that it's having a very hot summer already anyway. You know, do continue with that until you've gotten through this coming weekend. I mean, don't heat train all the way up until the day before the race. You know, those bouts of heat training, whether it's in the sauna or your car with the heat on, take a lot out of you. So come Monday or Tuesday, pre-race week, you can pretty much, I'd say, stop with the heat training. But for these next five, you know, we're doing this podcast on Monday. So for these 5 to 7, 8 more days, you can full steam ahead with the heat training. You can't do too much of it at this point.
Is there any time right before the race? So the race is on Saturday morning. Do you guys just shut down completely for a couple days before that, or are you always doing a little something? Because we talked about 12 days out, but what about the last couple of days, the last day or two? What do they look like?
And I'll throw this out. When the year I ran, Killian was running. It was the year that he won. After packet pickup, he and his entourage took off for a slight jog up to the top of escarpment. And I was thinking,
That's craziness. What's he doing that for?
So, yeah.
The day before.
So tell us about what mortals should do and what about some of the elites.
Well, Mike Wardian's probably going to race the uphill challenge.
Yeah, he is.
On Friday.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's such an animal. Yeah. Wow. That guy is amazing. So for the mortals.
Oh, wait, no. I would, you know, Craig might concur. For the mere mortals and even the non-mere mortals, I would get, if you're in Squaw on Thursday, join the crew for the hike up, the nice relaxed pace hike up the escarpment to the flag raising. You get a little bit of altitude. You get a sense of what the first climb is going to be like. You could jog a little bit on that if you want. You could, once you get up to the top, you could look over into the Granite Chief Wilderness, jog a little bit. You might jog a little bit on the way down. But that's a really worthwhile experience. You're on your feet for, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. You're soaking in the Western States experience, but you're also getting a little bit of stimulation. And then I like on Friday to get out for just a little jog. You've got some nervous energy. Maybe it's 2 miles or 3 miles down the bike. If you're in Squaw, or if you're in Squaw, down that little bike trail, if you're staying at a place in Tahoe City or Truckee or somewhere, you could just go for a little flat jog to get your legs stretched out nice and slow. You know, and then rest the rest of the day. That's kind of a nice thing to do, I think, for the last 2 days.
How many beers would you recommend people drink Friday night before the race?
4 Sierra Nevadas in the can.
I was going to ask, where does ice cream play into a taper?
That would probably be a question for Tim Tweetmeyer.
Yeah, yeah.
He has an obsession with it.
That's a tweet question.
I had my coach tell me that all I needed to do for the last 12 days was sleep and eat ice cream.
No, 12 hours.
Oh, no wonder I was so slow.
Hey, Andy Jones Wilkins, thank you so much for inviting us into your tap room. And, you know, what I was surprised about, guys, was the cheesesteak, because that was a decent sandwich today. And the wedge cut fries, a little garlic on them. I knew the beer was going to be cold, and I knew it was going to be have a great deal of variety. But the cheesesteak, Andy Jones, now that what I thought was good.
Look at that stare.
He's going, what is he talking
what are you
about?
Saying?
There you go, man. We're
hello.
You're in the tap room. Did Skype freeze on us?
Next time, try that. No, I'm here. You guys hear me?
Yeah.
Did Skype freeze on us, or did we stump AJW?
No, next time you got to try the bratwurst.
Maybe that's what surprised you. Thought I ordered that. No, I ordered the cheesesteak. That was good stuff. Hey, can you get two guys that know more about this course than the race director and the most passionate trail runner out there on Western States? I think it's always been AJW. He just loves it. So off the top of his head, I'll tell you, he wasn't looking down at notes, because as he was going through names and times and referencing, he didn't glance down once. He was straight ahead staring. So he knows his stuff. So thanks so much for both of you joining this race, or this podcast, rather.
And we'll see you in Squaw.
You started that, didn't you, Andy Jones-Wilkins? Hashtag see you in
Squaw. See you in Squaw, guys.
Love it.
Yes,
all right.
He did.
Now go out and see you in Squaw.
Mas.